This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
Food and travel. They go hand in hand. And chances are, if you're a fan of Heritage Radio Network, you love them both. Between April 10th and 24th, we have 6 incredible food and travel experiences up for auction at charitybuzz.com. Go on an underground food tour of New Orleans with a rocket scientist. Get your hands on VIP passes to Feast Portland, or enjoy a ranch-to-table experience in wine country. 4 of the experiences include hotel stays at some of the most iconic properties across the country, including the newly reopened Hotel Claremont in Atlanta. Now's your chance to win the ultimate bourbon and beyond weekend in Lexington, or take in a Latin food tour of New York's outer boroughs. You'll eat, drink, explore, and relax, all while supporting Heritage Radio Network. Help us keep the lights on and the mics hot. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/auction and bid now.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43 and the Good Beer Seal. Today is Tuesday, April 10th, 2018. We've got some great guests joining us tonight in the studio. I'm really happy to have Yeppe from Evil Twin back in. How are you, buddy?
I'm good, thank
you. Good. We've got a lot of news to talk with you about. You're going to be opening your first physical brewery in New York City this year.
Yeah.
So that's a big part of the show. And we got some special guests, top-rated advanced Cicerones and certified Cicerones that are going to help us get a nice conversation going. So you guys go around the room and introduce yourselves.
What's up, guys? This is Chris McClellan, and I obviously live here in New York City.
Hey, guys. I'm Angela Style. I'm one of the advanced Cicerones coming in today and just moved back to the city.
And I just want to say, Angela's one reason we put this show together, because she came here in the fall, reached out to a lot of beer people, from Patrick Donaher. I think you reached out to like everyone in the New York City craft beer
community. I had a hit list.
You did good. And now she's here, and she passed the advanced Cicerone. That's a big deal. And we got a couple. And Chris, also, you should say you're a certified Cicerone, but you probably will be taking the advance again.
I am, yeah. And I'm actually taking the advance next month. So it's full crunch time right now.
It's kind of interesting, isn't it, Yeppe? I mean, not too long ago, nobody had these credentials. But you've probably seen a lot of people taking these tests.
Yeah, I mean, I don't follow it that closely, actually. I'm so caught up in my own world and what I do. So, but I hear about it and read about it, but yeah.
Yeah, it's cool. We'll learn more, because suddenly out of the blue, it's kind of like almost de rigueur for, you know, people working in management in the industry. And like Matt, you're working at Union Beer, but you're only 26 and you're an advanced Cicerone too.
Yeah, that's correct. Thank you for the introduction. Matt Dinowitz, one of the advanced Cicerones, New York City native, living in Brooklyn right now, work for Union Beer Distributors. And I just want to say real quick, it's pretty awesome to be, you know, amongst some pretty awesome company right now. And thanks for having me.
Great, man. And Zach, he's our boy who writes for Thrillist.
Hey, Jimmy.
About beer sometimes.
How's it going?
All right, ABC Beer Company.
ABC Beer Co. Thrillist
Prices in the East Village.
Well, thank you, yeah. And certified Cicerone awaiting results.
So you just went to Miami and you took the test.
I did, Miami. Yeah, it was a lot to take in and a pretty busy time of year for me. And studying was, you could always say you wish you had more time to study, but I think, you know, I did better than I thought I would. We'll find out. And if I have to take it again, I have to.
You're already breaking out into a flop sweat from the memories of studying right
PTSD
now.
PTSD is still fresh.
Yeah, it's a side of beer I never thought that people would be studying for tests. I remember, I don't know, 10 or 12 years ago, this guy, Sam Merritt, was hosting the intro-level Cicerone beer server classes in the back room at Jimmy's Number 43. And I remember, I thought that was hard. So, but it gave me some, you know, self-knowledge and stuff. So, yeah, but let's talk about this. You know, it's been out there for a couple of years. You're talking about, you know, opening a brewery. You've got a location in Ridgewood. Miguel, the beer tracker, did some great photos.
Mm-hmm.
We saw his construction going on. So tell us about it, you know, why you decided to open a brewery after all these years.
I mean, many reasons, and we've been working on it for a long time now. You know, Evil Twin is 8 years old now and has been exclusively a contract brewery or gypsy brewery or whatever you call it, and we have done a lot. I mean, we have managed to grow a pretty big brand that's worldwide and, you know, that people seem to like. It's been fun, and we've been loved doing it, and with all the challenges that comes with contract brewing. So when I moved to New York 6 years ago with my family, you know, the plan was to move all the production to the USA first of all, but also to become a part of the beer scene in New York City, and you know, we opened Tust and Luxus and all that stuff, which was a step in that direction. And we kind of felt now that the last step to really become a New York brand was to actually have a physical brewery in New York. You know, I wanted to build a brewery since I started, pretty much. I just haven't had the time because I have so much going on. We have a distribution company in Europe also that's growing like crazy. So, you know, finding time to do all these things hasn't been easy. But, you know, it's important for us to renew the brand and to stay focused and do new stuff. And to build that brewery was just the next step. And you know, we found a cool space, and it was obvious to take that and run with it. So yeah, it's exciting. There's a lot going on. It's a big project.
Cheers, man. Welcome to the show and welcome back. Thank you. Last time we had you on, you had come out with the food and beer book, which was a great book.
Thank you.
Your Luxus Chef.
Is it that long ago?
It seems long.
Yeah.
When we're doing this.
It probably is.
Yeah.
It was like a year and a half ago, wasn't it?
Something like that.
It's a beautifully shot book. I still look at the pictures in it sometimes.
Yeah, thank
it's
you.
Absolutely
thank
beautiful.
You. Yeah, see, that's, you know, again, that's, you know, staying busy is not a problem. You know, all these things, it's not something we plan to write a book. It's not like, hey, I want to write a book, but, you know, Fight on our publisher came along and said, hey, you want to write a book? And you got to do that when they ask. So a lot of the things that's been happening the last 6 years since I moved to New York is something that wasn't planned, but it kind of just was, you know, came to me, and I just ran with it. And now with the new brewery, it's kind of the same thing. You know, we had been looking for a space for a while and couldn't really find one that we liked and had the size that we wanted. And then guy called me up and said, hey, I have a space for you in Ridgewood. You should come check it out. And it was, you know, amazing space, nice size, good location, all that stuff. And we were like, hey, we gotta take this. So that's kind of, you know, it sounds like it's all a coincidence, but it kind of is sometimes, you know. I don't like to plan too far ahead. If things happen, they happen, and I run with them. So,
yeah, man. Angela, you know, and Zach too. You guys jump in if you want.
I was gonna say I have to explain this to a lot of people. On top of writing about beer and coming on the show every once in a while, I also own a shop and a bar, and having to explain to people kind of the concept that Evil Twin has used to grow, do you ever feel like you have to explain to people that it's sort of like the cart before the horse in some cases? It's not like, for some brewers, that makes sense, like what you've done to build such a respected and well-deserved respected brand. Do you find that, like, you've had any problems establishing yourself without a physical brewery to call home, or?
No, I don't. Not from a business perspective. I mean, we have been doing really good, and we're making 20,000 barrels of beer and selling it all, and, you know, people seem to like it, and, you know, it's more from a personal standpoint that I want a brewery, just for my own satisfaction. You know, I'm getting older also, and traveling the world is fun for a while, but it doesn't stay, you know, it doesn't keep
being. What are you, like 27, 28?
Something like that. plus, minus.
You need a place for your kids to hang out, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No, I mean, yeah, so, you know, I get asked a lot, why are you opening a brewery? You have such a successful business model and it's going really good. And yeah, why am I opening a brewery? Now all the problems start, right? So, you know, first of all, being a New York brand is very important for us. And to become that New York brand that we wanted to be, I think we need a physical location. Also, you know, we are at a scale now where when I make a new beer, it's no less than 100 barrels, you know, and it's kind of like a big bets to play around with. And sometimes I'm like, maybe this is a little too much, but we kind of have to do it that way because I can't do small scale anymore. It's just too time consuming. So to have a small, you know, we're doing a 15 barrel brewery in Ridgewood, so to have a small brewery where we can play around and try new things and you know, test recipes and maybe move them to bigger scales, also something that I wanted for a long time. And then the whole thing about selling directly to the consumer is, you know, it's a big thing from a profit perspective. Right now, we do a barrel-aged stout down in South Carolina, for example. We have 100 cases. The whole world wants it. You know, we can send 3 cases to California and everybody gets upset that they can't get more. And, you know, we don't make any money on it because it has to go through all these distributors. You know, that's also, you know, frustration. So all these things added up to just it making a lot of sense for us to just do our own stuff. And now we can, you know, we're going to build a big tap room. We're going to invite, you know, all the collaborations. I brought collaboration beers today for us to taste. And I'm doing a lot of collaborations also because I'm a gypsy brewer. I don't have a brewery. So for me to go out and do collaborations in Virginia or Australia, wherever it is, it makes sense because that's, you know, that's my whole brand. It's built on working with other people. But I've never been able to kind of bring people back into my brewery. And I want to do that. And a lot of people that I work with are like, hey, you should open a brewery so we can come brew with you. Yeah, and, you know. Yeah. So that's
the also favor. This might have get Angela on. She's new to New York, and I don't know if you have any questions for Yuppie.
Yeah, actually, I thought it was kind of interesting that the place that you ended up settling on, because we've been discussing so much that you've been this gypsy brewer, the place you ended up settling on is a city where the rent is so high, the conditions are so rough, but it seems to me that perhaps maybe it's a culture kind of issue for you, where that's why you made this your landing page, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Again, that's a lot to say about it. I've heard myself say a lot of times lately that I cannot recommend anybody opening a brewery in New York City because it's very complicated. And, you know, the scale that we do it at, it's not a huge brewery, but it's pretty big. I mean, it's probably the biggest since, I don't know, Single Cut or something like that out in Queens. It's extremely expensive. There's a lot of, you know, permits and registrations and all kinds of stuff.
I mean, I saw
you make it sound so easy.
Yeah, Miguel's photos, it's basically like you're just digging up the floors and what you're putting in drains. You're basically rebuilding an entire building.
I am, and there's nothing unusual about that when you build a brewery. The problem is that we do it in the middle of New York, so everything is just more, you know, takes longer, costs more. People, you know, everything in New York is so expensive. It's like, hey, we have to do this. It's like another $5,000. You're like, $5,000? I mean, really? To do that? It's just an expensive place to do it. And then when we own the brewery, you know, then all the trouble starts. I like to tell the story about, you know, when you have spent grain, everybody, you know, they're so happy they can give it away to farmers and they come pick it up and all that stuff. In New York City, you have to pay people to come pick it up, right?
Yeah.
So it's like... Yeah. It complicates a lot of things to be in the middle of a big city. But on the other hand, and that's why we're doing it, because, you know, we actually looked upstate, actually. We looked for a bigger space upstate to just be out of the city and do more out there. But to be able to do it in New York City also brings a lot of attention to what we do. And, you know, the whole world looks at New York from a food perspective and art perspective and music and all that stuff. And to be able to build a brewery, it's just going to give us... an attention that we wouldn't get if we were outside of New York or if we were in a different state, I think. So all in all, I think it makes sense. Again, I wouldn't recommend it.
I always like to say that we're not here for the cheap rent. You know, exactly. you come in for the experience.
And the rent is just a small part of it. But yeah, we got the space that we have now that we're building out. Now we got the space in April 2016 and we only started building out in January 18. So we actually paid rent for more than a year and a half.
Oh my God.
15,000 square feet. Can you imagine how much that cost?
No, I don't want to. Right, Angela? I don't want to. Chris, you got a question?
Yeah. So I sort of looking at the industry, we were actually talking about this. Zach and I were talking about this earlier at Zach's Bar, and we were talking about looking at the health of the industry, right? And so you mentioned kind of selling direct to consumers. I work for Guinness, and which is a very interesting perspective because I'm the world's biggest fan of great local beer. I think it's vital to communities these days. But at the same point, you know, when you look at a lot of the markers out there, it seems like people just forgot how to drink beer. You know, when you look at what's going on, just from a volume perspective and across the industry, do you feel like, what's your take on, especially your perspective, given what you've done and your business model, what is your take on what's happening right now in the U.S. beer scene? Do you feel like we're incredibly healthy? Do you feel like we've got room to grow? Like, what's your kind of perspective on that?
See, again, that's...
Is that bubble bursting, I think, is how everyone's phrasing it.
Yeah, no, I don't think it is. I mean, it's a very big question, right? And it takes a lot of answers. I mean, you obviously all see what's going on with Green Flash latest and Smutty Nose and all that stuff.
R.I.P.
And I got to be honest with you, I'm not surprised at all. I kind of knew that was going to happen. And hey, that's a good friend of mine, Carlo. He owns this place.
There he is. Yeah.
Chef Carlo Maracci.
Yeah.
Like you do.
One of the best chefs in the country. Anyway, so yeah, I would say I'm happy I'm not at the scale where Green Flash was because I think those guys are struggling a little bit. I mean, we see they just went down. on my level, 20,000 barrels or less, I think we're pretty healthy, and I think we can keep growing, and I think there's way more to be done if you were smart about it. I mean, it's not about just making good beer anymore, because a lot of people are making good beer. It's actually hard to find bad beer. I mean, and that has changed. That's a big change from a couple of years ago.
Quick, Yappy, what's the beer that we're drinking?
It's the sweetest beer you ever had. It's a collaboration I did with The Vale in Virginia. One of my good friends, Matt, we've done a couple of collaborations together, and he wanted to do a stout, and the first one we did was kind of, you know, it was the infamous fried chicken beer where we played on the Cracker Barrel thing. So now we wanted to do another one where we played on a big, you know, this is Honey Nut or whatever they're called, Honey Nut O's or whatever they're called. So we wanted to make a beer with lots of honey and lots of nuts in it, so... Big
cereal beer.
Big sweet, yeah, exactly. Big sweet imperial stout.
I feel like it's cloying in the right way.
It is pretty yeah, the right way. I don't know about that.
It's definitely a dessert beer.
It
for
is
sure.
100%. But yeah. It's great.
It is a good one.
Thank you.
Hey, we're gonna take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes and talk more about this cloyingly sweet beer on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Good.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. This is Katie, HRN Executive Director, and I'm so excited to share with you our coverage from the Charleston Wine and Food Festival.
We are here live today at Charleston Wine and Food.
Join us as we talk all things food.
Come to Charleston, eat some seafood. Eat all of the seafood.
Chicken fried chicken with chorizo steak and salsa verde mashed potatoes.
So quintessentially like Southern fare. At its finest.
And have important conversations.
We're also talking about professional women in restaurants and how underrepresented they are, people of color in restaurants, and how they're not talked about.
We get real with Food Network's Manit Chauhan.
Balance is BS. I was told that I wasn't going to be bleeped out.
And find out about raising sugarcane with Chef Sean Brock.
It's like being Indiana Jones or something. You never know what you're going to find.
You'll come away inspired by the power of food and the food scene in Charleston. Here's Dr. Jessica B. Harris.
Food is constantly in flux. Food is always moving. Food is the only real lingua franca that we have that allows us to connect with other folks.
So tune in to Heritage Radio Network on tour at heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't go wrong.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. You know, there's so many podcasts going on around the country and around the world, but Heritage Radio Network, this is about 10 years, and we've been here almost 9 doing Beer Sessions Radio, over 400 episodes. So check all the archives. You can go back now on Spotify as well. And there's so many beer industry people that have been on the show, including, you know, Yeppe from Evil Twin is back on the show tonight. He's been on quite a few times. He's opening a physical brewery out in Queens in New York City, and we've got four great advanced or on the way to being advanced Cicerones here as well. So, Yeppe, we're just talking about the beer that you made at the Vale and collaborations. I know these guys have some more questions for you.
All right.
I honestly love the Vale guys. I actually went down there for the first time about a year ago, and they seem like a natural fit for you. So I'm someone who gets to see you both as a writer, like I said, and as someone who owns a bar in a retail environment where I get to see people's expressions when they try your beer for the first time, and it's almost universally like surprise and joy. So I'm just curious, you have some of the most diverse offerings of the beer out there. And that's saying a lot for a very crowded beer market. You have very inventive stuff. This Honey Nut Yepios, am I saying that right?
Yeah.
Is definitely, I've never had anything quite like this.
Honey Nut Yepios.
you could do something with that.
We never got a lawsuit for some weird reason.
I'm shocked, honestly.
Jimmy's voiceover talent coming in there too.
I'll sing the song for you.
This isn't a challenge to General Mills for a cease and desist, but I'm very impressive in its own right. But
thank you so much.
Where do you come up with do you just kind of wake up with, you pass like a pack of Starburst on the street and you're like, I should make a beer about that, or hear a song, or like, what's your method? I know this is such a banal question, but I want to hear what you have to say about it.
I kind of do, actually. I mean, I don't see myself as being overly creative, and people always tell me I'm very creative. So it's hard to know where it comes from, because I don't think in a creative way, but I get a lot of, obviously, I don't want to say good ideas, but I get a lot of ideas, and
some of them are
good, right? I mean, I spent all my, waking hours on eating and drinking pretty much. I'm huge into coffee, cocktails, food, wine.
Palate exploration.
Yeah, it's like I get inspired from everything that I taste. It's often things that I taste that I get inspired from. Sometimes it's other things, but most of the time it's things that I taste. And I get more inspired by cocktails or wine these days than I do from beer, because I pretty much know beer. I've been in it for a long time and I've done it so much. So for me to get inspired by all these other, beverage or food items that are not directly related to beer, but you can kind of bring into beer, it's fun. And I've worked with cocktail bars like Aviary and PDT and stuff like that, and it's cool to work with these guys because they have a different approach to flavors. They know flavors, but they have a very different approach. They don't know anything about beer making, so they come to me, and we make the beer called James Beer with Aviary last year, which was a Berliner Weisse with strawberry and olive, which sounds extremely weird, and it ended up making a lot of sense because, it turned into kind of a Gose, where the olive brine kind of gave the saltiness to the Gose.
And salty, it was, and sweet, always a good thing.
Yeah, and it's like, I didn't come up with that idea, but they came to me and said, hey, we have this dessert at Alinea in Chicago that, has olive and strawberry. Could you turn that into a beer? I'm like, hey, this is a pretty good idea. And then you have to figure out how that works,
It's also perfect for James Beard Foundation. That was for James Beard.
It was, exactly.
So chef-y in a way.
Yeah. Do you feel like I'll take the position of the big established beer company, just for argument's sake here? And what I'll say is that, do you feel like, nope, they don't expect you to make any particular beer at this point, right? You can just kind of put something out. It is creative. It is unique. It's interesting. And you have that kind of license. But it's easy for you to do that, right, at this point?
Definitely. When I started out with Evil Twin and being a gypsy brewer, a contract brewer, I didn't have any investments. I made a beer. I sold it. I made another one. I sold that. Which means that I could do whatever I wanted. I didn't have to have a flagship beer to get a certain, cash flow going or anything like that. I didn't need that. So that was a big help from the beginning, for sure. Later on, when you establish a brand and it becomes what Evil Twin has become, and it's expected that we do all these things that are kind of out of the ordinary, sometimes it feels a little too easy. It's like, no matter what I do, people love it. And it's like, do they really love it that much, or do you just think they love it? Obviously, it's fun for me. I still, and this might sound weird, but I still, when I make a beer, even for how weird and funny ingredients I add, I always try to figure out some kind of a balance. I like gimmicks, but I don't like gimmicks just for the gimmick. It has to make sense also. So when does it make sense what I'm saying? I'm not trying to just make fun and not trying to just do crazy stuff. Just to do crazy stuff, I want it to be drinkable also.
Matt, you got a question?
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, I don't mean to like butter you up or anything like that, but definitely a big fan. And I think it's obvious that you were one of the first to kind of like come to the scene and just kind of be an expression of like art, right? But in beer form. And we're talking about this right now, and really anything goes. You could concept something and have a crazy inspiration and make it in beer form. Kind of want to segue that into, with the new space coming into play, how will that function with the future? And like, I don't want you, like, I don't know if I'm gonna reveal it. So the question is, are you gonna like have more like of a portfolio? I mean, you're obviously always gonna do these interesting experimental things, but what does the future hold as far as your beer lineup is
concerned? We kind of have a portfolio now. It's just very big. I mean, we do... new brewery is going to be a playground for sure. It's going to definitely be even more a playground. You know, I just went out and talked to Carlo, who owns Roberta's and Blanca, two Michelin star restaurants in the back. And the first thing he said was, hey, when are you open? I want to come out and make a beer, you know? And it's, you know...
Pizza
it's,
beer.
It's such a cool position to be in where, you know, one of the best chefs in the world, when I see him, he asks, when can I come out and make a beer, you know? So that's definitely the stuff that we're going to do out there. I'm not a big fan of just doing the same things. You know, you say art, and a lot of people want to compare us to, are you an artist? Are you a scientist? What are you? I always say, I actually compare it to being a chef. I think making beer is the same as cooking. You pretty much just put some ingredients together and you try to make something that tastes good come out of it. It's kind of like making a soup. You just ferment it, right? And that's my approach to brewing, which also means that, hey, if you're a chef, you want to make new dishes all the time. You don't want to be there, stand there and do the same thing over and over again. You want to create new dishes. And that's what I want to do. Every time I sit down to make a new recipe, or come up with a new beer, a new concept, I think about, hey, what can I do to, you know, change what I already done, or how can I come up with something new? And it's not like every time I make a stout, I start all over. Obviously, you know, there's certain ingredients you have to use to make a stout, you know, and when you have one base recipe that works out, you kind of go from that when you make a new one. Same thing with cooking, you know, it's not like you start all over every time you have to boil a pot of rice, you know, you kind of know how to do it, but you can use a different rice, you can have a different spice, and that's kind of how I approach it. So,
well, that's why I think we're also impressed with what you do. It's not just like anyone can do weird shit, you know, anyone could just put a bunch of varying ingredients together and try and make it work, but it's the fact that you execute it, that's the part that gets us going, is the fact that these flavors can come across like, oh, what would you say, olive and strawberry, was it? I mean, who would have thought of that? But the fact that it could actually come through.
Yeah.
I
had a weird question. Like, there's definitely a lot, like you said before, like gimmicks for the sake of being gimmicks are a plenty these days. And I know that's definitely something that if you just were to read off the list of ingredients in your beers and no one ever got to try them, then they might see that. But I've tried the majority of your beers and that's not the case. Like, have you ever had in the sake of being, let's call it avant-garde or a little culinarily driven, have you ever tried something that like you immediately regretted? Like I don't get to see your list of failures. I only see your list of successes. Is there anything you've ever done that didn't work out?
See, now it's...
Can't tell you.
No, it's going to sound weird that I said... No, I mean...
He doesn't remember. He's so good.
I've definitely had beers that I didn't...
That's success.
That I wouldn't want to do again. Just because, you know, it's... I actually know when I make it that this is a one-time thing and I want to try it out, but it's not something that I want to continue to do. I mean, no, I don't want to call it failures. I mean, even beers that end up tasting weird and not as good as I wanted them to, it's still a learning curve. And I'm not saying that, hey, I'm just trying things out and I'm selling them to the consumer and, you know, they're just going to buy the stuff that I'm experimenting on. But again, I've made beers that I didn't care for too much, and then I have people come up and say, hey, this is the best beer you ever made. And I'm like, see, you know, taste is different, and you got to be careful trying to make what you think people want all the time, because, you know, and that, which is also why we never describe the flavor of our beers on our labels. A lot of people do. It's like, you know, you make a brown, it's like, oh, it has notes of coffee and little bit of, you know, roastiness and blah, blah.
Instead, you could be beautiful poetry on the side of your cans.
Yeah, we never
very
do. That's on purpose, because I don't want to tell people what this beer tastes like, because every taste is different.
You think it'll lead them to certain expectations
plus
as well.
People taste different things. You know, I might taste coffee in this beer, somebody might taste something else, you know. And my point is that I never make a beer for, you know, I make it for myself, and that's, you know, that's easy to say, but I actually do. It's always something that I want to try, and hopefully, you know, some
quick yappy. What's this beer? We're on number two.
So that's a collaboration I did with a small brewery down in Florida. It's a longer story. I Radiohead, that I've been a big fan of for a long time, was playing in New York,
so
and
good.
I missed buying tickets, so I put on Facebook, hey, I need 2 tickets for Radiohead, and some random guy emailed me, say, hey, I have 2 tickets for you. The only thing you have to do to get these 2 tickets is you have to make a collaboration with one of my friends who opened a brewery down in Florida.
What a deal.
I was like, all right, let's do it.
Well played.
Obviously, it took me like a year and a half to get it get it done because I'm so busy, but we made it happen.
What's the name of the brewery?
It's called Gravity Brew Lab. Tiny little one. And this is actually a Belgian dark ale, quadruple kind of style, which I don't make a lot of, but I wanted to do something different. I was going to Florida to brew with Johnson Wakefield and Cycle and a couple of other guys, and they all make stouts, and they all wanted to make stouts. So I was like, hey, I don't want to do another stout, so let's do something totally different.
That's good. One thing you mentioned, not putting the flavor components or whatever, the tastes on the label. I think we've talked about that a lot because, the vocabulary, the words that people use to describe taste, some of them are outdated. They go back to like 19th century wine terms, horse blanket and manure, and barnyard flavors. And if you don't, I think everyone tastes those differently, and especially coming from wine to beer. So I think you're onto something. I don't know if anyone else wants to talk about, how you describe things when you're tasting them, and in particular, like in the Cicerone tests.
That was one of the biggest parts when I just did the advanced, was being able to come up with really robust adjectives to be able to express what you're tasting. I do a bit of side writing for spirits tasting notes and for wine tasting notes. And I feel like those places you're allowed to be a lot more descriptive and say things like grapefruit zest and like horse blanket is a common term, but when's the last time you heard someone try to sell you a white wine that, like, well, the cat piss or like weird scents or like peach cobbler, things like that. Like, he's pretty much nailed it. Like, some of these people naming beers after specific foods will lead you to that stuff. But I think beer is entering the point where all I can come up with are like tangential food pairing notes that lead me to where I'm tasting.
I think sometimes too, right? Like, what's very important is like who your audience is and who you're speaking to, right? And sometimes we have this tendency to standardize things, but really, you do it perfectly right. You want, everyone's gonna have their own interpretation at the end of the day. So, and with respect to like the Cicerone exam, it's going back to that audience. It's, you can get super cerebral and say very obscure things, but you'll lose someone immediately if they can't relate.
Well, that's what the advanced Cicerone exam, anything especially beyond certified Cicerone, is really about. It's for those of us who are looking to be able to move between technical conversation and consumer-friendly conversation, talking about transunional and damascenone versus oxidation, and using different vocabulary as well as descriptors. That's why even any time I've done staff education, which has been a huge part of my career, I don't start off beer 101 with beer styles. I think that comes second level. What we need to start talking about first is the palate. What are you getting on the mouthfeel, flavor, and aroma? Start there, and then you can have a conversation universally rather than this pegged specific conversation that only industry people will know. So I think palate plays a huge role for everyone and all, yeah.
Maybe she's got a point at this, and I'd be interested to hear what Yepi has to think too, because I think as Americans, we're obsessed with categorizing stuff, coming from the wine world, especially where you know what varieties, specific varieties of wine taste like, or when they come from specific countries. With beer, we're so obsessed with the idea that this has to be an IPA in a rigid format, or this has to be a brown ale in a rigid format, where I feel like a lot of the great beer cultures in the world have kind of eschewed any guidelines for, is this a sort of the thing, like when you enter a market like the United States, do you feel kind of compelled to obviously you're not restricting yourself in ingredients, but when you work with like the base idea of an IPA, what is like your kind of rubric for like limiting your flavor profiles? Are you not limiting rather, but like kind of constructing your flavor profiles?
And you could use this triple IPA that we're drinking right now as
which
an
is
example,
fantastic.
Because this thing is a monster.
Yeah. And it's again, I don't want to say that I'm against categorizing beers, but with that being said, I see it as a free blank, like what is called clean sheet kind of thing when I make a beer.
Pass.
And if you call it this or that, had you called this an IPA 5 years ago? Had you made this 5 years ago and called it an IPA? People would be like, this is not an IPA. This is more, I don't even know what it was. It didn't exist 5 years ago. I think that we have to be careful categorizing everything. And I know that's, taking an exam, a Cicerone exam, you have to categorize things, and I've also judged competition and stuff like that, and that's all about categorizing, and that's fine because that's kind of what this competition is about or what this exam is about. But as a brewer, I do not think about styles. Obviously, we have to put a style on the label, so we have to say, hey, this is an IPA or this is what it is, and often I made Molotov cocktail, which is a 13 IPA. It's pretty much a barley wine, you know. It's a hobby barley wine, but, you know, we just decided to put IPA on because IPA sell better than barley wines, you know. And it doesn't really matter if it's one or the other because I knew exactly what I wanted out of it. I knew what I wanted it to taste. I knew how much alcohol I wanted in it. And if I call it a barley wine and IPA, I don't care. I mean, it's not up to me, to, you know.
So. Yeah, but which beer is this that we're drinking?
This is a collaboration I did recently with a pretty young brewery up in just upstate New York. I don't remember the town.
But it's Middletown. Called
Equilibrium, 2 years old. Amazing, amazing brewery. Amazing people. I met them. I was reading about them, and I emailed them and said, "Hey, you guys sound pretty cool. Can I come by?" And I went up there, and we talked and had some beers and some hot wings and. You know, we came up with this collaboration, and these guys, you know, for me, it's like, I'm considered kind of old school, being 8 years old now, and for me to work with these young guys that are 2 years old, they, you know, it's cool to be inspired by what's going on right now, so.
It's cool, big guy, 8 year old with the 2 year olds.
Exactly.
Yeah, man. Hey, we're going to take one more short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, guys, check it out, heritageradionetwork.org. Become a member, and there's a lot of fundraisers going on. This is listener-supported radio, so heritageradionetwork.org. So, Angela, so quickly introduce yourself again, everybody, because you're Angela.
Hi.
You're the reason we did the show, because yeah. You're a new advanced cicerone, moved here from Michigan.
You. Yes, I did. Thank God I came back. I love you, Michigan. I know where I'm from, but I know where I need to be, and this is here.
So we're drinking beer with Yeppe from Evil Twin. What were you going to ask him?
Well, I just found it interesting, too, your comment, especially about, you know, categorization, talking about styles, or especially when we were talking about Cicerone program and things like that. A lot of frustration that people find with that Cicerone program with the exams is how rigorous they are about the style guidelines. I mean, memorization of these specs. I mean, IBU, ABV, OG, FG, AA, I mean, pretty much everything. It needs to be memorization of these numbers that seem so irrelevant, especially when we have, like, I can pull up my BJCP app on my phone and find
Angela,
it right there.
Just for IPAs alone, how many different styles of IPA are there?
I mean, who really knows now? I mean, officially.
Does anybody know?
On, Matt? Like, say, BJCP,
I mean, I would
officially?
Say, like, 10 to 15, like, at least.
They just added, yeah. Like, three different types.
And there's so many more.
Hazy IPA.
Yeah. They don't even have that one on there yet, because they're still in the 2015.
That's Brewers Association, not BJCP.
Oh, gotcha. Yep,
that's
sorry,
the thing.
Yep.
That's the crazy part, though, right?
Like, yeah, there's two different ones.
What's the actual... Well, the BJCP is, like, brought in as such a style guideline bedrock, but, like, there's also things that, like, the market... You can't deny when the market puts these like hazy IPAs up, where for the last year and a half, there was no categorized version of this. Like Yeppe said, that beer never would have been considered an IPA, but it's been the bulk of IPA sales. Mm.
And I think that actually to the point that Angela made earlier, which is really interesting, that if you can either these days, especially in New York City, right, you can build a brewery and a brand on a reputation for being innovative or creative or having a quality product, right? Whereas back in the day, it was building it on one or two flagships and then kind of evolving from there. So the fact that you can just kind of throw a label on there and say, hey, this is a triple IPA, or this is a, you know, this is a barley wine, or this is a lager, you know, it's like, this is kind of gives people a rough framework to work within. And I think that does help, if I will make an argument in favor of styles, and that, you know, it does give people some vocabulary to work with, but at the end of the day, I think it's the quality of the brand that really kind of resonates
well,
there.
It
gives
do
people
like
the confidence to move in there a little
however
bit.
However strong
know?
It is.
10%.
But there's qualities I like. You know, there's like some really good Belgian strongs that are like this.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it's, again, I can say that this much. I would never be able to pass the Cicerone test because I don't...
That makes me feel a lot better.
You'd have your own test.
I could probably study for it, but, you know, again, I don't have that approach where I work within the laws or the borders or whatever the test set up or have set up. But and that, obviously, if you take a test to know about beer, there has to be some kind of result. Otherwise, why would you take the test? And I've seen the sommelier documentary. What is it called? About the Master Somms. And it's insane what these guys know. And you're thinking, you know, when you see that, what does that help them in, you know, in the long sense? I mean, obviously, they know a lot about wine, but do they actually need to know all these things?
If I may jump in, it's such a big topic socially anyway. But as a young woman coming in, I'm questioned every single time about my knowledge of beer. And I got to say that using something like, if I can put out there, hey, I'm an advanced Cicerone, it allows me that opportunity to hopefully skip silence that part people, of the mansplaining, yeah. if that makes yeah. sense, yeah. and let them. So in my case, that's actually been a big factor for that. But of course, that's not for everyone. And I don't think that everyone should be doing the Cicerone program. But for those of us who are new to the industry, who were, you know, just turned 21, excited about beer, whatever it was, it allowed us the opportunity to be like, hey, there's this framework where if you're a go-getter, if you want to do this and study your ass off and study yourself and really get to know any and all aspects of beer, this is one way and one format for you to do so.
Yeah, look, my feeling towards it, is it necessary? No, but I think it's a brilliant program in that it drives people to just deepen their knowledge. It gives credibility to the
totally.
Industry.
Yep.
And
I don't know if it came out wrong. I'm in no way against it. I'm just saying makes sense for, you know, if you want to be a bartender, and you come from scratch and you read about craft beer and you are, hey, I want to work at a beer bar.
We're agreeing with you because we ourselves have gone through it and we recognize the pitfalls and the pros of doing something like that. It's not for everyone. And like, for instance, I mean, Garrett Oliver or someone like you don't need to go in and take the master exam, for instance, to prove your beer knowledge. People, you guys are already established in the industry doing great work. But I think it again just gives opportunity to other people.
Well, now it's become a professional certification. Yes. It's such a big industry,
and it's also given us a forum, though, right? Like it's giving us this forum to be able to have this discussion in the first place, which I think is really, really healthy. You know,
Definitely.
Yeah. I think Yuppie's going to go and reform the test, and he's going to write all the questions.
I'm sure you put some interesting.
But Zach, you just took the test, so I want to hear the answer. What did you sweat out?
Honestly, like we've been talking about this.
What was the test like? Advanced Cicerone test.
The advanced Cicerone was like. It's relatively new. I like to tell the story about how I passed the certified Cicerone, and then literally 30 seconds later found out that they had added the advance through an email. And I had like a half a minute window where it was so special. But similar to what Angela just said, like I've never been a young woman in a very male dominated industry, but it feel like it is a good way for us to kind of certify that you do know something, like the one core
of
knowledge.
You're so good at identifying with all groups.
I'm trying, but it's important in an industry like this where there's a lot of opinion and a lot of anecdotal evidence, but there's not a lot of like concrete fact. And there's nothing to say that this has to be the core of everything we believe, but it's a good thing to kind of base certain opinions on and then keep open-minded about it. And like, I think if anything, beer, like food, is something that you should be able to take and tool into what you want it to be. And we are kind of using science and chemistry to make a product, but we are also being artistic with it, like Yeppe, and kind of putting our own spin on it. And we should all be able to interpret it the way we want. We actually were talking about this earlier, all four of us. Halfway through the advanced, I had this moment where I was like, why the hell am I doing this? Like, I don't understand, like, if this is going to mean anything. Half the people who see the word Cicerone on a page can't pronounce it. They don't know what it means. But when you actually have it at the end of the day, it's kind of grounding for you personally. Maybe a little reassuring, but it's also for to be able to walk up in a conversation and not to lord it over anybody, just to be like, look, I've done this one rite of passage. It kind of helps balance a conversation.
And I'll say you can help me with my draft system anytime you want.
The first thing you don't do, right, in the beer industry is walk up and say you have some sort of Cicerone certification.
Never.
Right? Yeah. So that's the worst person in the room. But at the end of the day, the conversation definitely gets the conversation started in certain circumstances, you know, and I think that's very important.
You know, as you're going forward opening a brewery, I mean, how are you going to staff it? You know, are you going to have to start looking for these types of certified people?
I mean,
have you thought about that yet?
I think we're in a pretty lucky position where we're not going to have issues staffing it. I think we get a couple of resumes a day, pretty much, from very qualified people, which, you know,
is need a bartender.
We need everything, but it's, you know, it's also, it becomes an issue that we get too many qualified. So, you know, now I have too many people that I have to talk to and figure out who's better than the other. I never wrote a business plan, and I'm doing a lot of business, you know, and I like not to plan it too much. I like to just feel it out, and we did the same thing with Trust. You know, when we hired the people there, we didn't ask about, you know, resumes and stuff like that. I like to feel people out, and I think you can learn a lot, especially with beer. I mean, it's not the most complicated subject in the world. I learned everything, you know, from myself, by just reading about it and drinking and talking to other people. So I know.
But do you feel like you read people well?
I think I do. Yeah, I do. I used to be a school teacher for 8 years.
So that
definitely helped me a lot. I don't know. I've been in it for a long time, and I've experienced a lot. I've kind of covered the whole aspect. I own a distribution company, I own a brewery. We had a bar. We had a, you know, beer restaurant. I've written about beer and all that stuff. It's, you know, I've kind of covered the whole scene, and from that, I've definitely learned to you know, understand where people come from and what people I can that can help me and what people that can't.
Yeah, B, I want to ask you a different question. A few years ago, you there was an article in Thrillist, and you picked like the 7 favorite beers of yours, beers that influence you. Now, just name a few other breweries that you really look up to, some other beers that you respect that aren't your own.
The beers that I can say, the beers that I seek out now, the beers that I drink, are either the new guys, like, you know, the Equilibriums or the you know, Trillium or whatever it is, or the very old guys. Like, and when I say old, I don't mean like German 1,000 years old, but like, you know, they stab this Jolly Pumpkin, stuff like that. I mean, I get inspired by all of them in different ways. I still get inspired by Jolly Pumpkin, just this whole approach to barrel aging and all that stuff. And I've known, you know, Ron for many, many years. And
Which is so funny. Like, coming from Michigan, no one talks about Jolly Pumpkin. Everyone outside of Michigan talks about Jolly Pumpkin. So that's great to
hear.
Yeah,
and everybody should talk about it because he was the first guy who started barrel aging for real in America. And he's, you know, he should be recognized from that. And Jolly Pumpkin is not a hip brand anymore, which, you know, that's what the world is. But to me, being a brewer and doing all the beers that I do and doing all these crazy styles and working with all these crazy young guys and all that stuff, to look back at what this guy is doing and how he's been doing that for up to almost 20 years now, it's like, that's still inspiring to me because he's doing something that's so unique that nobody else is doing, and it might not be the hip thing to do and it might not be the modern thing to do, but for me, it's still something that's legit and real. And plus, I'm also into wine a lot, and I see a lot of, you know, similarities from what he does to the wine world. So that definitely inspires me a lot.
I had a quick question for you. So, you know, we're talking a lot about, you know, your identity as being an innovative brewery, you know, different approaches to actually making beer, to talking about, you know, the saturated beer market. And so my background is I work with Union Beer Distributors. We're a craft beer wholesaler, and you know, I learn a market, and I'm in a sales function and role. So a lot of that stuff fascinates me, and it's just my background. Keeping all these things in mind, I guess the general question of, you know, what do you see the industry, you know, heading towards, in what direction? Like, what are some of the trends that we haven't seen quite yet? You know, because a lot of things come and go. I'm just curious to know from your perspective.
Yeah. I mean, pickle beer. Anticipate. It's all about pickle beer. That's the next thing.
I hope. See, that's, again, it's a big question. And I, you know, I get asked a lot, you know, from different magazines and publications to, hey, can you name what the new trend is? And it was easy a couple years ago. You know, you can say, hey, hobby sours, or you can say, you know, hazy IPAs and blah, blah. I don't know. I mean, I kind of... The last thing I heard myself say when I got asked from a magazine what's going to be the new trend is actually to look back in time a little bit. I think barley wines, for example, are coming back, which is like has been super unmodern for the last 5 years. But, you know, we've been through this whole craziness of you know, pastry stouts and hazy IPAs and all this, you know, fruity Berliner Weisses and all that stuff. I think to go back and start doing some of the styles that we used to do or that people used to do, and kind of, you know, pilsners are getting back, lagers are getting back a little bit also, to do these things and kind of perfect them more, I think that's going to be the next thing. If it's Belgian blonde, Belgian dark ales, or if it's barley wines, or if it's lagers, or if it's, you know, even Kölsch today, Kölsch is a pretty hip style just because it's like a clean, you know, that's what people want to drink. So I think looking back in time is kind of what the direction we're going in. With that being said, I don't think hazy IPAs are going out of fashion anytime soon. I don't think pastry stouts are going out of fashion anytime soon. I don't think fruity Berliner Weisses are going out of fashion. But for our own sanity as brewers and also for the sanity of consumers, I think it's good that we have these other styles also, because drinking 12% pastry stouts and 10% hazy IPAs is, you know, it's a little much sometimes.
It's crazy. Okay, now a question for the Cicerones in the room. Okay, he mentioned barley wine. What is a classic food pairing with a barley wine? And it's in Garrett Oliver's.
English or American?
Let's say English.
that was a question.
That
was exam.
The Cicerone response to your question. That's
this is what I want to hear more of. So what's a classic pairing with a barley wine?
I'm the junior one here. I'm handing this one off.
I mean, I would think, you know, we're talking, if we were talking, what do we decide, an American or English? I mean, if I were to say like American barley wine, it's obviously very reminiscent of a...
Is there a classic pairing?
IPA, I would say a carrot cake.
Yeah, like 5 pounds of blue cheese.
Getting there, Angela.
Yeah, see, I feel like actually with American, because it's especially more hop forward, more bittering components, especially more saltiness and cheese, especially is going to be more of the front runner, I think, when it comes to pairing. When you get on the English side, that's more of desserts. You almost even
so
like
what's an
creme
English,
brulee or
English
something
English blue
like that.
Cheese.
An English blue
Stilton.
Cheese.
Stilton, yeah. Thank you.
Stilton okay. Blue cheese.
Had to lead you guys there.
Oh, so
Garrett Oliver's book, Brewmaster's Table, one of the first
so
books
good.
That we know about food and beer pairing. To me, that's the classic that always stands out. Barley wine and Stilton, you put the two in your mouth together, they create something better. Right?
Although, to build off what Angela was just saying, last night I went to Bohemian over on Great Jones. I had this ridiculous, it was one of the best hidden little Japanese restaurants in New York City.
Thanks, New York.
Yeah, right, and of course. But I had Wagyu beef steak tartare on blue cheese toast, like Stilton blue cheese toast.
Nice.
And I wish I had an English barley wine or American barley wine with it.
And another couple more pairings that you like.
Yeah, and I think just speaking broadly to food and beer pairings, and Zach, you and I were chatting about this earlier too, so I don't necessarily subscribe to the, you know, like this with that kind of mentality. It's more about how you tee it up, right? Because it's all about the context. Hey, this is why I like it. This is why it's important
to me.
Which
one do you like?
Well, I mean, if we're talking about a huge beer, you obviously, it's going to overwhelm almost everything. And barley wine is about as big as you can get, right? So in that particular circumstance, it has to be, to Angela's point, something absolutely, you know, the salinity has to be off the charts. The, you know, the umami has to be off the charts, something that can really stand up to that, you know? So like a hugely juicy cheeseburger, you know, something that has a lot of those characteristics to it would be perfect. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's really how you kind of tee that up.
You got one, Matt?
I mean, it's something different from what we just spoke about, but we're talking about blue cheese. I had one particular blue cheese. I believe it was from Rogue Farms. They do a blue cheese over there, and that with Imperial Stout created something that wasn't quite present there at first, and it kind of brought out this smokiness character, which is kind of cool with food and beer pairing. You could create this almost like third element.
No, that's cool. And Yepe, last question. We're going to wrap up soon. So at your new brewery, you know, let's say you did a night, you're going to have... Is there a food and beer together that you'd like to serve at your brewery or for a special occasion?
I mean, we haven't decided finally what we're going to do with food. We're definitely going to scale it back. You know, we had Luxus and that was a lot of work. And we're definitely not going to do anything like that again. So I don't know. It's up in the air still. I don't think I want to answer that question, but just because we haven't made any decisions yet. We have talked to some cool people that we want to bring in, but nothing is decided yet. So,
right.
I do miss Luxus very much, though. That was a great restaurant.
Nothing lasts forever.
Yeah, beautiful.
That's a great one. Very toast true. To that.
Thank
nothing
you.
Lasts yeah. forever.
Cheers.
How do you say that in Danish?
You don't.
You say skål, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But let's go around one more time, everybody. So say your name, your affiliation, and your Cicerone level.
Zach Mack, certified Cicerone from Alphabet City Beer Co. And writer for Thrillist and Married Other Publications.
All right.
Matt Dinowitz, Advanced Cicerone, working with Union Beer Distributors in their shared brand program, overseeing Narragansett and Austin East Ciders. Shout out to two really awesome brands.
Great. And up and coming guys, only 26. We got some young guns here.
Hey guys, I'm Angela Style. I'm a level 3 Advanced Cicerone, and I work with the Beerly Legal Group, as well as working on some other consulting projects around town. I'm going to be the hired gun anywhere and everywhere in the city.
Great. Thank you. Welcome to New York, Angela.
Thank you.
Hello, Chris McClellan. I actually work for Guinness as an ambassador for the brewery, as a certified Cicerone, about to take the advanced. So now the flop sweat breaks out. But yeah, ready to rock and roll.
And Yuppie.
Yeppe, good to see you, owner and brewer of Evil Twin Brewing, the least knowledgeable people in the room with no Cicerone whatsoever.
He has no certification.
But
says it all.
Still respect.
I try.
Well, welcome. Everybody, this has been great. You got to check out Zach Mack. He's got a, what's your summertime gig? You got Governor's Island?
Yeah, we got Governor's Island opened up May 1st. The
beer.
I just jinxed it, but we're ready to go for Governor's Beer Co., which is the all New York City brewed beer garden on the island. And we're opening up a second new spot. It's a different venture, but yeah, stay tuned for that, and we'll be ready in
great.
The middle of the month.
And all you guys fans, just so you know, coming up this year, may have taken a back burner the last couple of years, but it's going to be the 10th annual July Good Beer Month in New York City and the 10th annual Good Beer Seal Awards. You know, way back when, 2009-13, the former mayor, Mayor Bloomberg, gave us 5 years of proclamations that July is New York City Good Beer Month. And we did a lot with that. And since then, it spawned, you know, the whole beer scene in New York City, over 30 craft breweries. And we moved our annual event from Beer Week to July. It'll be New York City Brewer's Choice in July. You're going to hear a lot more about it. A lot of our Good Beer Seal buddies and other, like, top New York City beer people will be on the host committee. We're going to come up with some a new and interesting beer event for everybody in July. So, you know, keep listening in. It's NewYorkCityBrewersChoice.com. And I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks to our producer, Justin Kennedy, engineer, David Tatasciore. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo!
Woo!
Thank you. Yeah, baby!
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.